good evening, good morning, all of my wonderful Richmond technologists. This is Ford, and you're listening to another episode of RVA Tech Talks, the podcast where I sit down with the gurus of Richmond's tech scene and ask them about whatever they're interested in. This episode is brought to you by Summit Human Capital. Whether you're building a tech team or just looking for your next gig, you're going to want to partner with somebody who actually cares about building a relationship with you, not just somebody who thinks in terms of the transaction and the bottom line. And Glenn Dearson, he witnessed this firsthand after launching a successful office in DC for a global staffing firm. And he came back to Richmond to create a new way of solving that eternal conundrum of staffing tech teams. If you're a manager or an engineer, you know what I'm talking about. And he wanted to do it in a way rooted firmly in what he calls key core values.
So I'll get here in the morning around, right around six. And the first thing we do is right when you walk into the headquarters, what we want people to see is our key core values. So right when you walk in, you're seeing right away, honesty, openness, effort. You're seeing every single one listed, because what we talk about when we hire associates here is it's not just living and breathing our key core values inside of work, because that's not really genuine. It's also who is the individual when no one's looking. And we're really looking for that. And it's easier said than done. And a constant reminder of social responsibility and what we owe to ourselves, our friends, our family, people that we may meet right off the street, and how they should be treated. So we want that to be the very first thing that you see, which it is. As soon as you come across that wall, you see our KCVs, which we live and breathe inside and outside the office.
So isn't this like 100% the guy you want on your side when you're either staffing a tech team or trying to find your next opportunity? I think so. Check them out at summithumancapital.com. This week, I had the pleasure of sitting down with none other than Roman Letier. And Roman is the CEO of Epon Technologies USA, which is the U.S. office of a French consulting company that specializes in data transformation, data engineering, cloud transformation, you name it. And I talked to Roman about sort of what it means to be in the cloud, why cloud is awesome. We talk about how Roman got to be the person he is today, about what he's interested in, what he loves doing in Richmond. And then lastly, what he loves and doesn't love about being a consultant. So this is a shorter episode, but sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. So Roman, the record button has been clicked. Welcome to RVA Tech Talks.
Thank you.
I'm excited to talk to you because for people listening, you know, I know you not only from going to other previous user groups, but from the user group that we organized together, which is Richmond AWS user group, if anyone's interested. I kind of know you through that and would love to just talk to you about your experience in technology, getting started, you know, how you got to be the Roman Letier that people know today. And then some specific questions about how to run a consultancy, especially, you know, the balance between being technical and being conceptual and being a leader and being a, you know, doing what the customer tells you to do, and just kind of how you do your business and how you do it well. So to get started, can you tell me a little story? Take me on a history tour through the life and times of Roman Letier from way back when, whenever you want to start.
Okay. So I don't do this often, so I have to think about it. But
and I should say, by the way, for everyone listening, I did not send Roman any questions ahead of time, so he has no idea what to expect.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the beginning. So the beginning was in France, I guess with my accent, it's no surprise. I remember when I was about 10 years old, maybe like a long time ago, my grandfather bought me my first computer. And to this day, I'm very grateful for it because my grandfather was a Spanish immigrant in the south of France, and he wasn't well off at all, you know. And when I think of it and the price of the computer, I'm very, very grateful to him that he did that. He passed away a long time ago. But the first computer was an Atari 600 XL, so like a pretty old computer. And I remember learning BASIC. I bought a magazine at the time and they had a BASIC tutorial. And I think I was maybe 10 or 12 or something. I remember learning BASIC
What made him do that? Do you remember? Like, what? I mean, because I imagine he wasn't like an was he an engineer, or was he just?
No, he was working at the time. I think his job, he was retired when I was a kid, but he was a construction worker, and his specialty was cement.
Cement. So what made him say, I want to, you know, get this computer for Roman? Was it, did you ask for it, or was it just sort of like,
I did not, but you know, I wish I knew, but he died when I was 13. So I never had, long complicated conversations with him. And right. He knew that before that he gave me a couple of electronic games, and I really enjoyed them. So maybe that was just because I enjoyed them that he gave me that computer.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you learn basic, and you're not even a teenager yet. What happens next?
Well, I guess I got into coding. So I did a lot of programming, if I remember, when I was a teenager. So for instance, my first program I can remember was, I had a lot of magazines, and I would organize them using a basic program that I created. So it was like a library of one, and I would, if I remember, maintain like the list of magazines I had with a code so that I could find them and categorize them.
Well, that's kind of interesting. So you would so you had like a little, you would basically be able to find, you'd have your magazines in a box somewhere, but you knew exactly where to find it based on the program.
Yeah. It was pretty useless, but yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. And then we did some simple games. Then I got an Atari 512 ST. Well, I got an Amstrad CPC. Those were popular in Europe. But yeah, just a bunch of computers, I guess.
So at what point did you decide to go actually to school for it? I mean, I'm guessing you went to school somewhere for technology, or did you? I mean, maybe you didn't actually.
At the beginning, I wanted to be a physicist. So okay. I went to school to learn physics. I did a lot of maths. And then I went to engineering school in Paris. So I lived in the south of France, and I picked a school to study computer science.
Okay.
But I didn't study much at the time. I managed a film club, so that was my passion for a while. So I strayed away from computing for a few years.
I feel like that confirms my stereotypes of like French people, is that they like, you know, they like film.
Oh yeah, I love it. I dressed in black, smoked cigarettes. We have to go through this as a French people.
It's like a rite of passage.
That's my phase. Yes. I went to the Cannes Festival every year. I really loved it, and I wanted to be a film producer.
So what made you like?
It didn't happen.
What made you say, hey, maybe the engineering route is better for me?
I mean, I guess it just was just natural. It just happened. My first job was after engineering school was at CERN. So I was super happy because it was my dream as a physics fan to work for CERN, the particles lab in Geneva. And so that was my first job, and I was in charge of a database for the main accelerator just for a year and a half. And it was a lot of fun to be there. It was like a dream come true. And that's where I met my wife.
Really?
Yeah, she was my wife is from Virginia, and she was an au pair at the time in Geneva. And I met her in Geneva.
Oh, that's cool. So you're managing this database, and like, what's it like managing a database for something as intense as a accelerator?
So it's going to be super shameful, but it was at the end of the 90s, and my job was to create a web interface for physicists to see the different versions of the accelerator. So the accelerator, they keep changing it. They keep adding magnets, removing magnets, and they have version control. So you can see at a point in time what the accelerator was like. And I developed a web interface where you could pick two points in time, and it would give you the differences in the accelerator. And you know what? I used to do this at the time, and at the time it was okay. PL SQL, stored procedures. So the HTML, everything was stored in the database.
Oh, interesting. I mean, that's there are pros and cons to that design. That's really cool though. So, after that, how did you jump from like what came next? So you met your wife. Did you come to America when her, you know,
not call her yet. Back? So after that, so a big thing too is I just fell in love with being abroad. So I really enjoyed Geneva. Where Geneva was, I was actually technically in France, but I traveled some before that, and I really wanted to leave France and see the world. So after CERN, I took a job in London, in the UK, with an American consulting firm called American Management Systems. They are known as CGI now. They were acquired, and a pretty big firm. And I was super excited to. I took their job because they would move me to London, and it was super exciting. So the first day, I tell my new employees sometimes that the first day I showed up with my suitcase in London, and they put me in training for a week in Objective-C. After a week, they introduced me to the customer, and I was an Objective-C programmer. I had to perform very fast, and that's when I fell in love with consulting, like the thrill of learning something very fast and performing at the same time. And I really liked it.
Yeah.
In a new country. That was fun.
Right, right. So how good was your English at that time?
As good as now.
So pretty good. So
I can't lose my accent. I'm like super, super ashamed of it.
Wait, so but you have a, you're, it's very easy to tell what you're saying. So your accent coming to America for the first time was pretty good.
But it was the same, hasn't changed.
Okay. Yeah.
My kids make fun of me still, but yeah, in London, I do remember that in my first meetings for months, every time in the meetings, I would just stop everybody and say new word. When somebody said a word I didn't know, I would be like, that's a new word. And everybody would stop and explain to me the word. And,
that's great. That's
that
good
was
for
pretty
you.
Funny. Yeah. That's and after a few months, it stopped. Like you got less frequent, but that was pretty funny.
You know,
it was a really
like,
good experience. Yeah.
I feel like as an American, I have to do, I mean, a smart person does that, I think. A person who wants to become smart and learn does that. You know, I have to admit, sometimes when I hear a word, I just nod and pretend I know it. And I actually have no idea what the word means. I mean, I learned, and even Americans learn new words every day. I learned a word yesterday. It's called Ourobro. O-U-R-O-R-O-B-R-O-U-S. It means a serpent-like shape that wow. Symbolizes like the cycle of beginning of like beginning and ending and beginning and ending. It's like, awesome. It's not affinity. It's more like a kind of like circular serpent-like shape, a Ourobro. Anyway, so just to your point, I have to stop and say that even now, sometimes pride gets in the way. But anyway, so you're falling in love with consulting. You're working for a big firm. What happened next? So from there, you know, is it just consulting big firms until you moved to Richmond, started working for Jimworth or?
So then I took many assignments. So that was the beginning of it was during the dot-com era, which was awesome because they put me up in a nice apartment in downtown London. So I had the time of my life. I spent all my money on beer and cabs. It was great. And, you know, many customers, I really enjoyed it, walking everywhere. And, you know, the thing I did at the time is every time there was a new project, a new opportunity to do pre-sales or anything, I would just raise my hand and do new things. So, for instance, I remember once somebody came in and said, we have a project in Egypt, in Cairo, in Egypt. And I didn't even know what the project was. I was just like, all right, I'm going. And so that's something I liked about being a consultant, is just being up for anything, you know, at the time, just totally. Trying to learn stuff.
What's one thing that you don't love about consulting? What's the hard part that you, the bad that you take with the good?
No, that's a good question. Well, I guess, you know, the adrenaline, of course, is great. You know, this having to perform and get to know a customer really fast and show value. Because, you know, when you come in as a consultant, you're not cheap. So people see you as an expensive resource and you need to show you bring value. So it can be stressful. I guess there can be situations where you don't figure out how to bring that value, I guess. So it can be stressful at times. If you're on multiple engagements, it can be stressful too, because you have to like prioritize things. I guess. So, you know, a thing I see sometimes, and I talk to people, for instance, at Ipon, we have people that left because it's a horizon thing too. So for instance, if you are an employee in IT in an organization, you can see things through with a longer horizon. So you get to build something and you get to maintain it for a long time, refactor it, and you get like I think a different horizon. And so there are really two ways. When you're a consultant, you mostly come in, get something done, and then move on. Mm. So, you know.
So the challenge there would be just like not being able to build something or not being able to kind of steward something for a long period of time. That can
be. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Sometimes you want to have your baby and keep it. So, but what I believe in a career, because after being a consultant, I was an employee, you know, when I came to the States. I think it's good to alternate. And I recommend to my junior employees, you know, sometimes they want to leave. I say, you know, go try a different, you know, be an employee somewhere. You will see different horizon. Maybe then you want to speed up your learning again and do a phase of being a consultant again. Right. So I think a career is very long, and it's good to know you have options between being a consultant and an employee, I guess, regular employee.
I'd like to pause for just a moment and mention this week's sponsor, Summit Human Capital. If you need technology, recruiting, or IT services, aka if you have a talent gap on your IT team, or maybe you're just an individual in search of a new career opportunity, well, you're going to want to check these folks out. Because at Summit Human Capital, they just do things a little bit differently. And that approach focuses on relationships, not just transactions. Your engagement with Summit Human Capital starts by working to uncover your vision first, your own personal vision for yourself, for your career, for your business. Because the Summit Human Capital family wants to genuinely and authentically know your broader goals. And once they have a pulse on that, they can be extremely effective at finding the right fit. They also know that that vision may change over time, and that's why they think in the long term, not just the short term. And they want to be your service of choice, not just today or not just tomorrow, but next year, next decade, forever. The Summit Way is all about building these long-term relationships and positively changing lives for your company, for your business, for the people around you, for yourself. And if you're a candidate that's ready for the next career move, or maybe you're just an employer with a huge talent gap, a burning talent gap on your IT team, then please reach out to summithumancapital.com and allow these folks to prove why they consistently rate 5 out of 5 stars, why they've grown 1,000% over the past 2 years, why they're the best in town. Summit Human Capital, positively changing lives by connecting talent to opportunity. So let me change gears real quick and ask you about, I feel like we're at present in terms of the story of Roman and how you got into consulting. Maybe I should ask one more question about kind of how you got to where you are now. Maybe two questions. What was the job that you had before EPON? And then since you've been at EPON, can you just describe for people that don't know what EPON is, like what EPON's all about?
All right. So I'm going to try to stack the questions. So first, the first question is a trick question because I worked for Ipon twice. So after my stint at AMS in London and then Germany, I worked for Ipon in France, in Paris. And that's the only year I worked in Paris in 2004. At the time, they were a pretty small consulting firm in Paris. I got to interview with the CEO and the CTO directly. And I really liked the culture because the CEO was a judo champion, so as you know, and it creates a very atypical kind of culture, a good mix of engineering and action, I would say.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I worked for Ipon twice, and then I came to the States in 2005. My baby daughter was born in Paris, and with my wife Amanda, we took her to Richmond, Virginia. I worked for Genworth for 9 years as a programmer, then a manager. I did my MBA while I was at Genworth and learned business. And then Ipon called me back 6 years ago again. They had grown, and in a way I had grown in my skills, and they wanted to start operations in the States. Hmm. So that's the whole story. I worked for Ipon twice, and in the middle I was at Genworth.
Gotcha. Okay. And so when you made the switch from engineer to manager, what was that like?
That's a good question. So when I was at Genworth, I made the switch from programmer to manager. And at the time, I think it's a very, very different job. You know, I remember thinking about it that there are some things that I missed from being an individual contributor. I feel like when you're at the time when I was an individual contributor, I could be the hero many times. Like for instance, production went down. There was a production issue. I could debug it, get all the logs, find the problem, fix it, and be the hero. And I feel like success was easier to define when I wasn't a manager. As a manager and dealing with people, I think things are a lot more complex and fuzzy at times. And you are successful through the success of other people, which is awesome. I know that's learning that is a, I think it's a process. And something I like to say is the biggest difficulty, I think, as a manager is when you mess up in code, you can press undo. And when you mess up with someone, you cannot, there is no undo function. And that's been very hard for me to learn.
Yeah. That honestly, that kind of scares me. I think a lot about my sort of where my career is going. And I definitely see reasons why I might be a good manager, but it freaks me out sometimes thinking about the fact that I can't be the hero. I definitely identify with that because when I'm the hero, I can control whatever I'm doing. I can be the one to make sure it gets through the finish line, and succeeding through empowering others is definitely would be a new thing for me. So I always ask people who went from engineering to manager. I've thought about it, and it kind of freaks me out because I'm also like, what if I miss too much being in the code all day and building things with my hands and have to kind of watch from the sidelines and cheer on others? But those are.
I'm sure you would be awesome at it because I feel like you have a good EQ, emotional. You know, you're good with empathy and stuff.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I just I don't know. This is therapeutic, Roman. Thank you for talking about it.
But yeah, I mean, it is a transition. It's important, you know, because you don't want to be the manager that just still wants to perform better than everybody and be like still behave as an individual contributor.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So you're leading a team, and so you start this business here in Richmond, Epon USA.
Yeah.
And what was that like, starting, kind of coming to this city, and you, obviously you've worked at Gymworth and maybe you have a little bit of a network at this point, but how do you go from zero to, you know, an operating speed with creating a consultancy? Yeah.
So first, I mean, I had kind of a easier task than other entrepreneurs because all I was doing was starting a subsidiary from scratch.
Totally.
So, you know, I had the help from the founder of Epon. It wasn't, in a way, also not that easy because it was the first subsidiary that we started at Epon globally. So it's not like opening a Chipotle or something where you have the recipe and just go. But yeah, I had the help from my partners in France. I can tell you that it was super exciting. I missed, in my previous life in Europe, I was like traveling and learning new things. And I love to grow and learn stuff. And starting something new like that, I had a blank slate, and it was super exciting to just, I could go wherever I wanted, you know, talk to any company, or even my days were a lot more free. So yeah, at the beginning was super exciting.
So where has Epon kind of carved out a niche for itself coming up to present time?
Maybe I should say, because I guess it's an interview, I should explain what Epon does. So Epon is a consulting firm, IT consulting firm. So there is a theme here, and we specialize in discovery to delivery. So it means we can intervene from inception, from an idea to actually implementing. And we do work in mostly in data engineering, cloud, and application development. So, and we usually do work for larger companies, so mostly enterprise type of companies.
Okay. So, Roman, how do you build a cloud from scratch?
That's a good question. That's a good interview question. Well, you hire Epon.
Okay. So whenever someone thinks about a cloud problem, what are the big tenets they should keep in mind?
Okay, so that's a good question. So I think, you know, it used to be that people had to be convinced of moving to the cloud and public cloud, and I think more and more it's becoming more mainstream. And so everybody understands the concept of changing your expense from CapEx to OpEx, getting more agility in the cloud, so being able to deliver things faster, having access to more advanced services. I think one of the gotchas of cloud maybe is how you get into the cloud. So many companies are tempted to do a lift and shift, if you heard this. So you just take your stuff that you have on premise and just forklift it into the cloud and hope to get the benefit from the cloud. And then you realize that you didn't reduce costs, that you didn't gain agility. And so you have to be careful when you do a migration to really choose how you do it. Like, what are you going to optimize for the cloud and how you do it? Otherwise, you have bad surprises.
Totally. So there's the accounting benefit from the CapEx OpEx thing. So your accounting models change, so you can free up decision making, I guess. Like, what's the big thing with the CapEx versus OpEx? Yeah. Like, what does that allow you to do?
You know, I would just use what a customer told me, like just last week. I was talking to a customer and they said, what I liked about the cloud is before, when I had to do a refresh of my infrastructure, so upgraded, I had to put a line in my budget that would just eat up the budget for the year and I would just like eat it. And now what I can do instead is I can spread it by just having the flexibility of the cloud. I can spread it and use my OPEX budget to go up and down as I need. New capability.
Interesting. So whereas in the first scenario, it would eat into your budget, as in like you wouldn't be able to, like when you went to plan for the year, you would have is the CapEx budget somehow more like rigid than an operational expense budget? So like in OpEx, you might be able to like move around costs here and there to support cloud.
Yeah. But what happens with CapEx, if I explain it right, is so for instance, you buy a bunch of hardware. You say, okay, I'm going to buy like 10 new huge servers. And then the complexity too is you have to forecast things. So I remember doing a capacity planning class like a long time ago where you have to look at all your workloads and kind of forecast what you're going to do for the next 10 years. Like the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. Then you buy the hardware and then you depreciate the hardware along these 5 years.
Right.
So you have to be really good at doing capacity planning. I mean, and who does that, you know, like for 5 years? And then, you have to ask for the capital budget to do the initial purchase. And then on the books, you depreciate every year.
So instead of having that flexible OpEx expense where you can decide each month, almost like subscription pay as you go, you're essentially signing up for whatever the amortization is of that CapEx item, because every single month you have to pay it.
Right. And then your line of sight is you don't have to forecast like for 5 years. You can be a lot more agile with what you do.
Totally. Okay. That makes sense. So instead of, so I guess maybe I'm overcomplicating it. So instead of buying the car, you're doing Uber, kind of thing.
I guess that's a good view. Yeah.
Okay. So there's that benefit, and then there's the benefit of just being able to have the flexibility. So like, what does that mean for people? Like there's the financial side. What was the next benefit that you mentioned?
I'm
trying to kind of
think
through these.
I think the next one I would say is in terms of accessing state-of-the-art services. So say once you are into, I'll pick AWS, I guess we do a lot of AWS work. So if I pick AWS, once you have your application in AWS, say you want to do machine learning on top of your data, where you can use SageMaker. Say you want to move your batch to real-time because you need to have a faster decisioning on your data where you just pull Kinesis. So you have access to a library of services that you can just pick from pretty easily.
It's almost like getting, going to a resort instead of like trying to build, you know, go into some place in the middle of nowhere and kind of like figuring out, okay, where do I get my food? Where's the police station? What's the 911 number? Like, how do I actually survive in a foreign town? Instead, you just go to a resort town and then you have everything kind of already served up for you.
Yeah, that's very true. And there is a downside to it. But first, I need to remember to connect you with Peter Choi, our data leader, because he likes analogies, and that would be a good one. but I think the downside of your analogy, and it's a very good analogy, is once you are in the resort and say you want to try something new, like another restaurant, and go maybe like downtown, try something new, it's not that easy. You're kind of stuck.
Yeah, they're like, actually, the resort shuttle doesn't go there. Sorry.
Right. That's good. That's a good follow up. So I would say that's the thing. That's another thing to be careful about. And these are just decisions that you can make as a business, is how dependent and the lock-in decision, you know.
Totally.
I would say that sometimes, most of the time, maybe companies are too afraid of the lock-in. But I mean, it really depends on the business situation.
Right. Yeah, I think knowing what I know about AWS and all of the integrated services, there's just so much power in you know, being in deep with AWS. I mean, and I'm not sure if it's the same with Azure or GCP or OpenShift or what have you, but I know with AWS, there's just so much interconnectivity now that, I mean, you can run stuff over AWS's backbone network to speed things up, so you're not even going across the internet, so it's faster and better for security reasons. And everything already is like, you know, everything is already just integrated out of the box. So it's like, oh yeah, your SageMaker workflows are already, they're expecting you to be using S3. And if you already have your data in AWS, then you're probably using S3. So it is crazy how much experimentation you can do and just how much you can leverage those like managed services. So what's another reason? So we've talked about those two big reasons. So the finance, I'm just trying to think through, and this is like a question for you, but like, so there's the finance piece, there's the innovation piece. I got one.
The time to market. Yeah. Time to market is huge.
Time to market. So that because you're not building stuff from scratch.
So because it takes care of the, how do I say that, the boilerplate, like the stuff that doesn't add business value, and you use like reusable services, you can go much faster. And in this day and age, time to market is really key because you need to beat your competition.
Totally. So not only is your stuff better because you're using these AWS or cloud services, but you can get started with them quicker.
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes people think, oh, cloud, it's lower cost. I think the main advantage is more, and that's what we try to do at EPON, it's the time to market. It's really the ability to evolve faster, iterate faster, and get your product out the door faster than your competition. That's the key.
Yeah. One extra one that's kind of related to this, but like, so let's say you want to build this new product. Like, one thing that I see that a huge part of the cloud and using the cloud services is like, you don't have to like hire like engineers. Like, you don't have to hire an entire team like of infrastructure engineers to stand up a custom machine learning workflow. You can just use these AWS services. So it's like yes, sometimes you do want to hire, you know, specialists to build things from scratch in a very specific kind of like proactive way, but to me, a huge win with the cloud is like, you don't have to hire, you're essentially hiring AWS, you know, you don't have to hire somebody to build it for you. You can just buy it right off the shelf. And that just like, I mean, cause I hate to say it, but removing people from the equation is huge. Cause then you can invest more in the people that you do have and like your strategic advantage, instead of just like paying engineers to build things that are kind of like undifferentiating, you know?
I mean, everybody, you need to spend time on business value, and you know, so you can repurpose the engineers to spend more time on business value rather than reinventing the wheel.
Right.
Especially if you're not a pure tech company, because if you're a pure tech company, you can afford to do that. But you know, if you compete on business side, it makes more sense.
Totally. Yeah. What's that? The article that guy wrote, Nicholas Carr. Nobody cares about your IT assets or something. He wrote that kind of like super offensive, it was a controversial article at the time, but it was kind of a bold statement that like, nobody cares about your infrastructure. Nobody, literally no one. It's not there to do anything but deliver values.
It's hard to hear as a techie, you know. It's a message that's really hard to hear, but that's
totally
because I like to geek out too.
Yeah. So I got some personal questions for you. What do you like to do in your spare time outside of I guess are you the CEO of Vpon USA?
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah,
the lead consultant. I don't know what the
boss man. I like to say boss man. I should say boss person.
What's boss in French?
Patron.
So other than being the chef, what do you do in your spare time?
Good question. So I'm obsessed with running. I do a lot of running.
Okay. What's your favorite loop or what's your favorite run in Richmond?
So that's a good question. So I have a group of friends, awesome friends I run with. We have a running group in town. We run from Libby and Grove, and we have our routes. So I'm going to give a shout out to Rogue Runners, RVA.
Okay. Yeah.
And we meet almost every day, and we run quite a lot.
What time do you meet?
Usually it's 5:30 a.m. So we run from 5:30 to 6:30. Then we have coffee.
Okay. All right. So at that Starbucks at Living Grove?
Yeah, where because of COVID, they closed it. So we're really sad, but we found a new coffee place nearby. But it's a very important part of my life. It's like getting up, running, my social time in the morning, and then I just get the day started. And,
how far do you guys run?
So usually like we run 7 miles on a normal day. But sometimes we add a bit before, like we have some city challenges, but yeah.
So do you run marathons and stuff or do you just,
I do, I run marathons. I love that race.
How do you run the Richmond one every year or something?
I've run Richmond 7 or 8 times.
Oh man. That's
so
awesome.
not every year, but I've run it many times and I really like the course.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things to do. I don't know why.
I my favorite run is the Buttermilk North Bank circle.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful. That fills me up. So, what do you do? What's your favorite thing to do in Richmond? Like when you're not running? So let's say you're on just like a Saturday. If I told you you couldn't run, what would you do?
I like to cook. So my typical weekend is very simple. I go running, then I come back and cook for my family.
That's awesome. What's your favorite dish?
Good question. So there is a French dish I like to make in wintertime that usually gets me good reviews. It's a beef burgundy, bœuf bourguignon. It's a pretty rich stew with a wine sauce. And usually by the time it's cooked, I'm cooked myself because one glass for beef, one glass for me.
That's cool. Roman, where can, is Epon hiring right now? Just so you can put a little shout out.
Well, yes. Thank you. And actually, you know, we've been, the whole like COVID situation has been awful. But we've been very fortunate that we're still doing well. I don't want to jinx myself every time I say that. We're still hiring. So we have a few positions. So it keeps changing. So I don't want to say anything stupid, but they're on our website. All people can reach to me. We've been like recently looking for a project manager in Richmond. But we always have positions for Java programming, AWS, data engineering. And sometimes for product management. So we started doing more product management. It helps us come in at the discovery level, at the inception level, and also project management.
Oh, that's cool. And so if people want to find you personally, where are you active? Twitter, LinkedIn?
So they have to spell my name.
Oh, forget it.
But yeah, I'm okay active on Twitter, of course, on LinkedIn, and I love social media. So yeah, on Twitter, well, you would have to spell my last name. My username is my last name.
What is it?
L-H-E-R-T-I-E-R. And you know what's funny about it is that in Argentina, they have a candy factory that's named after my last name. And sometimes I get mentioned with candy pictures from Argentina.
So, when someone just really loves their candy, they're like, hey, yeah, big shout out to you.
Yeah, it makes my day every time. I'm like, hey. Sometimes I say, because I say de nada, or, you know, I talk with the people. But yeah, I'm pretty active on Twitter.
How do you spell it? L-H-E.
Oh my God. Oh,
just come on. Come on. It's just so people can write it down.
You know, even for me, it's like I get exhausted when I spell it. And I have a collection of misspellings on my Facebook account. So yeah, it's L-H-E-R-I-T-I-E-R. I mean, I guess it's going to be on the webpage somewhere, right?
Yeah, so it's Lair with a silent H.
Yeah, the H is silent. Lair. Yeah.
And then tier, just like tier, like T-I-E-R, right?
Yes.
Oh, that's not so bad. At least it's not one of those like Polish names that's like, you know, 30 characters long. Yeah. My doctor's name is, I just call him Dr. L because his name is like 20 letters long.
Okay.
Yeah, so your name is not so bad. So
yeah, when they ask me to identify myself in banks, I say, well, you know, I'm the only one that can spell my name. And I go spell it. And they're like, okay, you're good.
It's like a password.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for making the time. And I enjoyed that chat.
Sure, that was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun chatting with you.
All right, guys, tune in 2 weeks for the next episode of RVA Tech Talks. And as always, we're tremendously appreciative of this week's sponsor, Summit Human Capital. And please reach out to them at summithumancapital.com. And a shout out to Claire Morgan at Notterly.com, who edited this episode.